So we are continuing our study in the visions of God. This is a study of the figurative books, dreams and visions of the Bible. We've been in it now for over a year and a half. Started with Abraham. Started with Abraham's first vision, where God made his covenant with him. And we've gone all the way through, and we're in the middle of the book of Revelation. And today we are going to be in, you know, a second. Let's see. Today we're going to be in chapter 10. If I can get back to there. But before we get into chapter 10, I want to make one comment about last week. Last week in chapter 9, you know, we had those two. The theme of chapter 9 was really the sixth trumpet. Fifth and sixth trumpets being blown. And those trumpets, all the trumpets were warnings, right? And they were warnings by various kinds of threats to Rome. The first four trumpets were threats to the earth. Trees burned up, sea, things of the sea destroyed, all those kinds of things. Then you had the chapter 9. You had the locusts coming out of the pit that would torment men for 5 months. Which was internal. It was internal torment. Only those people that didn't have the mark of the Lord, that God had protected, all the people who were not His, were tormented. And as we were saying, you know, being tormented basically is the consequence of their sin. God was opening up, you know, the consequences of their own evil upon them. And then you had the four angels of the river Euphrates, and they were told to let loose the plagues there. And what happened? It said, and there was this army, 200 million people with, you know, on horses. And they weren't just normal people. They had, you know, strange looking people. Horses were these terrifying beasts with snake tails and breathing fire and brimstone. And it said they killed a third of mankind. Okay, we talked about that. I did a little bit of research. I just wanted, before we get into the next section, I want to just do something. 200 million is the number. John's very specific about this. He says, and I heard the number of them is 200 million. And so I just asked a question. I said, okay, this is first century, right? This is first century. You got the Roman army. You got the Roman government. You got the Roman Empire. How big is that? Just how big was it? The Roman Empire maxed out at about 60 million. That's all the people in the Roman Empire. Christians, slaves, nobles, conquered people, everybody. The entire Roman Empire, 60 million people. The Roman army, remember last time I said, maybe it's 2 million. No, it wasn't even close. 450,000 at its peak, which was a couple hundred years away from when John wrote this book. 450,000, the total size of the Roman legion. Total size. So when you start looking at an army shows up at your border, remember the Euphrates River was the border, the eastern border of the Roman Empire. When an army shows up at your, that's 4.5 times the size of your entire population. 4.5 times? And how many is that? 50 times? 50 times the size of your army? Or 500 times? I can't even do my math today. It's more like 500 times. In other words, you're sunk. You know, if this shows up, you're in trouble. And at the end of chapter 9, remember, it said, and all the men and all the people repented not. It said, even after all these plagues and all the devastation and all the trouble and all the death and everything else, it said, and yet they repented not. So, in the scope of the book, remember we have the great throne room in chapter 4. We have the land show up in chapter 5. He takes the scroll. He starts opening the scroll. Every seal, there's 7 seals on the scroll. Every time he opens a seal, something happens. He gets to the 6th seal, and there's an interlude where it talks about marking and sealing those that are God's. Before all the trumpets start happening, before all the trouble starts happening, God's going to make sure that His people know they're His and that they're protected. That does not mean, by the way, that they will not suffer. It just means that they're protected. They're not being punished. They're his. And then you get at the beginning, when the seventh seal is opened, the seven angels show up with the seven trumpets. And they start blowing their trumpets. And every time one blows a trumpet, something happens. Right? And we just talked about these first six trumpets were all bad news for the earth. Bad news for the Roman Empire. Right? All kinds of cataclysmic destruction. These, you know, this tormenting locust plague. The giant army that we just talked about. In other words, God's going to take every, remember in the scroll, God brought all of his tools out, the four horsemen, and the cosmic disturbances and everything. He brought all of his tools out, and he said, okay, this is what's going to happen. Trumpets start blowing, he starts putting his tools to work. What do you have? Cosmic destruction, plagues of all kinds of suffering and death. And then we get to this chapter where we're at, where there's another interlude between the seventh trumpet, sixth trumpet, and the seventh trumpet. And what we're going to see in the seventh trumpet is the seven bowls of God's wrath are going to be introduced, and they're going to follow the same pattern. So this pattern is the organization of the center of the book of Revelation. I'm going to keep repeating it because it's important to keep in mind. All of this is in the context of the whole book. You don't just go grab a verse and say, well, I wonder how that applies to the Soviet Union in, you know, 1982. You look at the whole book. Okay? So, we've had a lot of death and destruction and horrible stuff. You know, terrifying visions, right? All these trumpets blowing. Remember, we kind of had the same thing here. We had the horsemen, right? Conquers and slaughter and famine and death and plague. And, you know, the rocks falling and the stars shifting and everybody screaming, you know, where are we going to go? Who can stand? Remember that? And then God gave an interlude of peace and comfort for his people. And he said, you're mine and I love you and I'm going to take care of it. And here you have the same thing. You know, a third of the sun, a third of the moon, a third of the stars, a third of the oceans, a third of the trees, and all the death and destruction, the locust plague and everything else. And now it's going to stop and God's going to say, here's some comfort. Now, remember the theme of the whole book. The one line theme of the whole book is God's people win. Period. Okay? Right below that is persecution's coming. Get ready. Be faithful unto death, and I'll give you a crown of life. The devil's going to try to exterminate the church with persecution. That's what we're getting into right now. Notice all of this has been God working. You haven't seen the devil fighting back yet, right? This is all God working, including the plagues of destruction, including the locust plague from the bottomless pit. All that kind of stuff is God working. When we get past, really when we hit chapter, we've got chapter 10, which is about the angel, this amazing angel in the little book, measuring the temple. You got chapter 11, which is the two witnesses and what's going to happen to them, and that's where you're going to start to see Satan fighting back. You got chapter 12 where you have the woman clothed with the sun, the great red dragon shows up, and there's war in heaven. And then the next several chapters are all about the beast and the false prophet. We're just starting to get into the part where you know, it's sort of like plays, modern day movies, they all follow a very similar pattern. In the beginning of any of these plays, you have kind of the introduction of the characters, right? You kind of get to know who's what, what's going on, what the issues are. And you may have some, you know, little major, minor events going on. But there's always a peak of activity. You know, there's that climax. There's a great threat. You know, all the summer blockbusters, right? The you know, superhero movies and, you know, alien invasion movies and all those kinds of things. They all have that. They build up this tension like there's no way they're going to get out of it. There's no way they're going to get out of it. And then they do, right? Book of Revelation is like that too. So what we're going to see after this little couple of chapters of rest here, even though there's going to be some persecution and some problems, then all of a sudden the devil's pulling out all the stops. He goes and gets the beast from the sea and the beast from the land, which is, you know, we'll find out later. We've already talked about it some. The Roman Empire and the cult of emperor worship, and he's going to sick them on the church, and he's going to try to exterminate the church. And of course, we know the end of the book. God's people win. So that's where we're at. Now, let's read chapter 10. I saw still another mighty angel coming down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was on his head, and his face was like the sun, and his feet like pillars of fire. And he had a little book open in his hand. And he set his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land, and cried with a loud voice, as when a lion roars. When he cried out, seven thunders uttered their voices. Now when the seven thunders uttered their voices, I was about to write. But I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, seal up the things which the seven thunders uttered, and do not write them. The angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land raised up his hand to heaven, and he swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created heaven and all the things that are in it, and the earth and the things that are in it, and the sea and the things that are in it, that there should be delay no longer. But in the days of the sounding of the seventh angel, when he is about to sound, the mystery of God would be finished, as he declared to his servants the prophets. Then the voice which I heard from the angel spoke to me again and said, go, take the little book which is open in the hand of the angel who stands on the sea and on the earth. So I went to the angel and I said to him, give me the little book. And he said to me, take it and eat it, and it will make your stomach bitter, but it will be sweet as honey in your mouth. Then I took the little book out of the hand of the angel and ate it, and it was sweet as honey in my mouth. But when I had eaten it, my stomach became bitter. And he said to me, you must prophesy again about many peoples, tongues, nations, and kings. Okay. So, I saw still another. I thought the still another was really significant here. How many majestic, powerful, awe-inspiring, overwhelming angels has John seen so far in this vision? The answer, a whole bunch. Right? A bunch. And look at this character. Right? So he shows up clothed in the clouds, pillars of fire for feet, face like the sun, a rainbow all around him, and he's so huge that he puts one foot on the earth and one foot out in the sea. Right? It's a big angel. And he's noisy. He says he roars as like a lion roars, but you can imagine a lion that was that big roaring. It's deafening. Now, how many times have I told you in Revelation, you have all this noise, right? Great sounds, great thundering. This is power. This is the power. This angel's powerful. He's, you know, we don't know much about the organization of angels. We know there's a whole bunch of them because earlier in chapter 4, what does it say? There's this huge multitude of angels. We know there's a lot. We know of a few specifically. We know some by name. We know Gabriel, right? We know Michael. You know, from the Old Testament. Gabriel from the Old and the New. Gabriel shows up quite a bit. We know Abaddon, the angel of the bottomless pit, Apollyon, the destroyer. So we know a few of these guys, but there's some of these other guys that we don't know. We don't know their names, but we just get their description. And they're awesome, powerful beings. And they're all servants of God. At least these are. We'll find out in chapter 12 that Michael and his angels fought against the devil and his angels. So there's some that defected to the devil, which means, of course, they have free will. That's another interesting aspect about angels you understand. Okay, but this angel's got a little scroll in his hand. He's got a little book, right? In the original language, it would have been a little scroll. And a voice from heaven comes to John and says, go take the book. Now, there's this giant angel, right? You think this angel, if he's going to put his feet on the sea and the land, right, he's probably 30 stories tall, something like that. Right, this majestic, powerful being, feet. John isn't flying around. Right, in the vision, he's supposed to go take the book. You know, John's this little. You know, if you were going to put this to scale, John's this little character down here on the sand. You know, but yet he's told, go take the book, and then the angel tells him to take it and eat it. One of the things that when you see this, and we had a similar thing in Ezekiel. Remember Ezekiel, where God said, "Here's a scroll, and I want you to eat it." Same thing happened, right? There wasn't a giant angel involved, but there was a scroll. And he said, what? How's it going to taste? Sweet as honey. Sweet as honey. But when you eat it, it's going to make your belly bitter. And we said it back then, it's the same thing now. It's God's word. And it's going to be sweet in the mouth of the prophet. But it's going to be about trouble. Bad news. Bad news is coming. It's going to make your belly bitter. So John goes up and he says, give me the little book. He gives him the little book. He eats it up. He says, sure enough, it's sweet as honey. And once I'd eaten it, my belly was bitter. And then the angel says, we're going to get to seven thunders in a second. the angel says, you must prophesy again about many peoples, nations, tongues, and kings. So John is already, you know, you'd think by the time we get into chapter 10 and 11, this is a long vision already. Right? We had some long visions. You remember Zechariah had all those visions in one night, right? We've had some long visions already. You'd think by now John would say, man, you know, it's probably going to start wrapping this one up. And the angel says, no, more to come. Yeah.
You keep saying tongues. Is that a reference to language?
Yeah. Well, here when it says peoples and tongues, it's talking about different languages, yeah, different cultures. When it says nations, peoples, and tongues, it means, you know, they might argue, the Britain and the U.S. speak the same tongue. Thereabouts, right? Close enough. And Australia, close enough. But we're different nations and peoples. Anyway, so he said, you're getting ready to have to do more work. I've got more work for you to do. You're going to have a lot more to say. In other words, you're not done yet. In fact, we know from the book, he's only about half done. And he's got a lot more to say. And one of the interesting things, some people look at this and say, it says, John must prophesy again about many nations. They think, oh, that means he's got to go, you know, he's got to go to all these nations and preach and teach and proclaim all this stuff. And then some people want to tie that into Jesus. You remember Jesus said, Jesus told Peter, he said, you're going to die much like I did. In other words, he predicted his crucifixion. And he looks at John and he says, what about this guy? And he says, hey, if he lives until I come, what's it matter to you? Right, you follow me. And then it says, John wrote this. He said, then it said, the saying went abroad that this brother would not die, that John would not die. And John says, no, he didn't say that. He just said, what's it matter to you? John clears all that up. But some people look at this and say, oh, so here's the Apostle John. And, you know, he was told that he was, you know, was going to tarry until Jesus comes. And so he's going to go wandering around through the world, you know, preaching to all these nations of kings for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. Not what it says, but the interesting point is, nor what it means. In Jeremiah 1 through 5, chapter 1, 5 through 10, Jeremiah was told that he was a prophet to the nations and that he was going to speak to many nations. Jeremiah lived in Israel in the vicinity of Jerusalem his whole life, with one small excursion to Egypt when he was taken there against his will. But yet God told him, you're going to be a prophet to many nations. Now how is that true? If God's word is true and his prophecy is true, then how can Jeremiah be a prophet to many nations?
He has to travel.
Nope. He didn't have to travel, but his word did. His word did. Jeremiah, we read Jeremiah. He's a prophet to us. We've studied Jeremiah. So it's the same thing with John. He says, basically, God's saying, you got a lot more to write, and this is going to influence, this is going to testify and influence a whole bunch of people. Now let's back up a little bit. This is a little short chapter, but I want to back up to this thing in the middle. The seven thunders. So he cries with a loud voice, verse 3. The lion roars. As when a lion roars, when he cried out, seven thunders uttered their voices. Now when the seven thunders uttered their voices, I was about to write. But I heard a voice from heaven saying, seal up the things which the seven thunders uttered and do not write them. Now this is really unique in Scripture. This is a book of revealing, right? It is a book of revealing. And yet, here's something, and John was doing his job, right? What did Jesus tell him in the beginning? The things that you see, write in a book. So John was being true to his commission, right? He was told to write it in a book. What was he doing? Seven thunders. He'd written down everything else. And all of a sudden, the great angel roars, and seven thunders utter their voices. And their voices, John's about to write down what they said. And the voice from seven says, hold it, don't write that. Now why do you think that is? It's really interesting. There's only one other thing, one other place in the Scripture where something similar happens. We'll talk about it. But why do you think that is?
It wasn't time to reveal it.
Well, that's true. It wasn't God. I mean, that's probably, it's an obvious truth and it's an important truth. It was not God's will for it to be revealed. That is the fundamental thing. John heard it though, didn't he? He knew what it said. In fact, I remember there's two other places. What about Paul? You remember Paul? Paul said, I knew of a man, and he's speaking euphemistically because later on it's clear that it's him. He says, I knew of a man about 15 years ago who was caught up into the third heaven and heard things that were unlawful for man to utter. Of such a one will I boast. But of myself I will not boast. I'll boast only in my infirmities. Right? That's what he's talking about. So he said, I had a vision. I was up in the third heaven. You know, I was up the highest heaven, and I heard some stuff that I can't utter. So there's another case. The other case that it happens, and this is a little bit different, but this is very important to understand in Scripture, is in Daniel. You remember at the end of the book of Daniel? And you remember in our study of the book of Daniel, how God started out with, and of course, you know, some of this was because of the visions he gave Nebuchadnezzar, and some of them were the visions he gave Daniel. You had the great idol, right, the different metals, the head of gold, and you remember? And that was talking about the empires, the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, and then the kingdom that would never be taken away, right? Prophesying about the coming of Christ, the coming of the church. And then you have the bear and the leopard with the four wings, and the goat, the he-goat, you know, with the one prominent horn that's broken off in four. I mean, basically, it's describing those same empires. And then the great beast that stamps them all together that has ten horns and great iron teeth, the Roman Empire. And then he gets into all this long detail. It's basically talking about the what happens after the breakup of the Greek nation. So remember, when Alexander the Great died, he died as a young man. After conquering the known world, his four generals took over. And really, two of them ended up dominating, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, right? And they became dynasties that ruled the northern, you know, Palestine and north, Greece, Turkey, Asia Minor, all those areas, and Palestine south, Egypt and Arabia, right? And they fought each other for years and years and years. And that's the context whereby you have the Hasmoneans, the Maccabean revolt of the Jews, the emergence of the Roman Empire, because this was the downfall of the Greek Empire. They fought a lot, and then the Romans finally took over. So all this is in, you know, a couple hundred years before Christ. And one of the things that goes on with in that chunk of the book of Daniel is all of a sudden, you remember how it started out with there's going to be four empires, and then there's going to be I'm going to zoom in on this part of it. I'm going to zoom in on the Greek part. I'm going to talk about what's happening with the Greeks, and I'm going to give you all the detail about it's going to break into four kingdoms. And then it breaks down even finer and finer and finer, zooming in. And it says, okay, there's going to be this one. He's going to send his daughter over here to marry this one, and that's not going to work, and they're going to try to fight over here. He's not going to do it. He's going to go over here. He's going to conquer it. He's going to do this to the temple. He's going to go. You know, it got really, really, really specific. And what it was laying out, and this was hundreds of years before the fact, God was laying out what was going to happen with the Greek Empire and all the stuff that was going on. So when we get to this place toward the end of the book of Daniel, when you talk about the 70 weeks prophecy, and we went through all that, it gets to the point where what it's really, we know what it's talking about looking back. But what it's talking about, because Daniel said, what's going to be the future of my people? That was the big question. And God tells him in the 70 weeks what was the future of his people. And what it leads up to is the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Now, he doesn't say that explicitly. He makes it clear that there's going to be an end and it's going to be a situation like that. But then he tells John, seal up the book. Seal it up. Because it's not going to happen for a long time to come. That happened 400 years later. He was told to seal up the book. But it happened 400 years later. Now remember, I said this in the beginning when we talked about, you know, when it says the things that must shortly come to pass, in the beginning of the book of Revelation, it says at the end of the book too, the things that must shortly come to pass. But Daniel was told something that happened 400 years later was so far in the future, seal it up. So this tells you, this is a really important clue for all the people who believe that all the stuff we're reading about in Revelation is not going to happen until the future. Thousands of years from that time, and you know, maybe this year, maybe next year now, The problem with that is that's not shortly come to pass. And Daniel was told to seal up stuff that happened 400 years later. He was told it was for a long way in the future. It was 400 years. So, for one, we don't know what the seven thunders uttered. But we do know God said, it's not my will for you to know what it is. Seal it up. So he sealed it up. I love it. I love the fact that John just does what he's told. You know, God says do it. He does it. Now, that's pretty much this chapter. This is a short chapter. And what I want to do now is I want to go ahead into chapter 11 and get started a little bit here. There's another point that I'd like to capture here, which is the measuring of the church, or the measuring of the temple. Let's read. Then I was given a reed like a measuring rod, and the angel stood, saying, Rise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and those who worship there. But leave out the court, which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles, and they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. And I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two lampstands standing before the God of the earth. And if anyone wants to harm them, fire proceeds from their mouth and devours their enemies. And if anyone wants to harm them, he must be killed in this manner. These have power to shut heaven, so that no rain falls in the days of their prophecy. And they have power over waters to turn into blood and to strike the earth with all plagues as often as they desire. When they finish their testimony, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit will make war against them, overcome them and kill them. And their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which is spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. Then those from the peoples, tribes, and tongues and nations will see their dead bodies 3.5 days and not allow their dead bodies to be put into graves. And those who dwell on the earth will rejoice over them and make merry and send gifts to one another, because these two prophets tormented those who dwell on the earth. Now after 3.5 days, the breath of life from God entered them, and they stood on their feet, and great fear fell on those who saw them. And they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, Come up here. And they ascended to heaven in a cloud, and their enemies saw them. In the same hour there was a great earthquake, and 1/10 of the city fell. In the earthquake 7,000 people were killed, and the rest were afraid and gave glory to the God of heaven. The second woe was past. Behold, the third woe is coming quickly. And we'll stop there. Okay. So this is a really interesting section. It's got a lot of echoes with the Old Testament. First of all, then I was given. So this is John. He was given the little book, right? Said, eat it up. He ate it up. This is the very next thing that happens. He says, you've got to prophesy about lots of other stuff. Okay. Then he was given a reed like a measuring rod, and the angel stood, saying, Rise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and those who worship there. But leave out the court which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles, and they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. Now, first of all, you got to ask, okay, that's what it says. What does it mean? First thing, he was given a measuring reed. A measuring reed would have been something, it's a long stick. We would have looked at it like a cane pole, like a fishing pole. It could be of various lengths. But you should remember from our study of Ezekiel was told the same thing. He was given a reed and told to measure the temple. Remember the last few chapters of the book of Ezekiel, that incredibly detailed description of that temple? And he was measuring everything. I mean, he reported everything. You could actually draw an architectural drawing based on what he said. He said, okay, this is so many cubits, this is so many cubits, there's this hallway, there's this many cubits, there's this many walls, there's this many cubits. He goes on for this for a couple of chapters. And what we said back then was, this was not supposed to be a physical temple. Some say, oh, it might be the temple in heaven, the New Jerusalem, or whatever. What it's saying is that God has very specific plans. Remember, this is after the destruction of the temple. This is Ezekiel's time. The temple, when he's writing this, is destroyed. It's in ruins. And he's saying, I have very specific plans to rebuild my temple. I'm going to keep my promise to bring my people back. Okay? But he was measuring it, and measuring it was a way of saying God knows exactly the dimensions of what he's doing and who's there and who's not. He has all the measurements. He knows all the details. So He tells him to rise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and those who worship there. Okay, so you might ask, okay, what's he talking about? The temple of God. And he just told John to go measure something, and he said it's the temple of God. Now, there's a couple of possibilities. Where are we in time right now when John is having this vision? In the late 90s, late first century. What is the temple of God that was in Jerusalem right now?
In Jerusalem?
Dust and ashes. It was destroyed in 70 AD. Okay? So it's not that temple. That temple's gone. What else could it be?
Spiritual.
Huh?
Spiritual temple.
If it's a spiritual temple, we're going to read about that, and I think you're right. The only other place it could be would be the heavenly scene that we just saw in chapter 4, right? The throne room scene. Because it had an altar, right? Remember, it had an altar. So, but I don't think that's what he's talking about, and here's why. First of all, he says, leave out the court outside the temple. The Gentiles are going to tread down the holy city. So you got the holy city. Let me draw a picture. You got... Man, I'm running out of room. You got the holy city, you got the temple, and then you have the inner courts of the temple. Okay, those are the things he's talking about. So, first of all, if it was the temple in heaven, would the Gentiles, and these are spiritual Gentiles, would they be trampling heaven? No. Okay, so we know he's talking about something else. He's not talking about the physical temple is destroyed, he's not talking about the heavenly. He's talking about something else. So let's find out what it is. Let's go take a look at 1 Corinthians 3, 16 and 17. Do you not know that you are the temple of God and that the Holy Spirit dwells in you? If anyone defiles the temple of God, God will destroy him, for the temple of God is holy, which temple you are. That ought to be pretty clear. Ephesians 2, verse 18. For through him we both have access by one Spirit to the Father. Now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens and saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being fitted together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you are also being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. So there you have two very clear passages that say the church is the temple, the spiritual temple of God. So when John is told to go measure the temple of God and those who worship there, what's he measuring? He's measuring the church. Now, fascinating thing here. When he says temple, there are several words for temple. The word he's using here is naos. Naos is not, you know, if you look at the temple... If you look at Jerusalem, you know, like if this was Jerusalem and this was the temple, you would have had the temple courts, you would have the courts out here where the altars were, you would have had the holy place, and then you would have had the Holy of Holies. Right? So he's saying, when he says the temple, he's talking about right here. He's talking about naos. The holy place. And he says, don't measure the courts. The courts of the temple was the outside of the building. So in Jerusalem, you would have said, I'm going to the temple. When I got to here, I would have said I was at the temple. Because I'm at the temple courts. I'm at the gate of the temple. But here he's saying, I want you just to measure the holy place. Don't measure the courts. Measure the holy place. Now, we've been studying Hebrews. And in Hebrews, what's it make clear? Christ is our great high priest, and we are also priests, and where do we function? We work in the holy place. We work in the temple. We are the temple. We just read that in Corinthians and Ephesians. So this is the spot that says, that's where the church is. That's the church right there. Now he's saying, this is interesting too, because he also talks about the holy city. Let's talk about the holy city for a second. So what's the holy city? If I'd asked you that question in 33 AD in Jesus' day, what would you have said the holy city was?
Jerusalem.
What's the problem? 70 AD. Jerusalem's destroyed. So what's the holy city now? The New Jerusalem, exactly. And we know that because the scripture tells us. Revelation 21, Verse 1, now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, the first heaven and earth that passed away, there was no more sea, and I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And then in verse 9, the angel with the seven bowls of the seven last plagues came to me and talked to me. He said, come, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of God from heaven from God, having the glory of her of God. Her light was like the most precious stone, and it describes how precious this was. Okay. So what we have here is another reference to the church. Now, isn't this interesting? So if the holy city, so this is the new Jerusalem, this is the holy city, and then the courts of the temple and the holy place. But hold on a second. If the new Jerusalem is the church, and only the center of the temple is the part that's not going to get trampled, what's he saying? Is the church about to get trampled? Part of it is, yeah. Is it going to be attacked? Is the goal of Satan? We've been saying it. What's his goal? To exterminate the church of persecution. Guess what? If they were out here and the holy city was you know, all protected, nobody could do anything. But he's saying, no, not only that, it's going to come right to the gates of the holy place. Yeah?
You talk about, you know, him using the measuring to read in chapters 2 and 3, Christ had measured the churches.
Yeah, I know your works.
He had
right?
determined. And obviously there is an expectation, and 5 of the 7 dishes were not measuring up.
Yep. So now when you see this, and I noticed, I read some commentary on this I thought was pretty interesting. You see these various, you're going to see lots of different metaphors used for the church. You're going to see a woman, a bride, a city, a temple. In the two witnesses that we talk about here in a minute, they're also talking about the church. There's lots of different symbols. And this is something, you know, we saw this when the Lamb was introduced in chapter 4, chapter 5. What did it say? You know, who's worthy to open the scroll? And John's weeping. And an elder comes up and he says, don't weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, is worthy to open the scroll. And who shows up? A Lamb. You know, so we have a lion, a root, and a lamb all show up, and it's all Jesus.
And he's bloody too.
Yeah, and looking as if he'd been slain. So we have, you know, it's very common in this kind of symbolic literature to have several different symbols applying to the same thing. So we have the holy city, that's the church, it's the New Jerusalem. Is the church going to get attacked? Because what does he say? The Gentiles are going to trample. Now, hold on a second. I thought Paul wrote that whole book of Romans, at least the first several chapters, to say, there's no more Gentiles and Jews anymore. We're all spiritual, right? We're all spiritual. Is he talking about physical Gentiles? Because we're physical Gentiles who were saved and in the church, right? When now, what is he talking about? He's talking about the spiritual temple. He's talking about the inhabitants of the spirit, the people who make up the spiritual temple, which are Christians, both Jews and Gentiles. And now he's talking about spiritual Gentiles. So if spiritual Israel is the church, spiritual Gentiles, or the unspiritual, basically, are all those that, what? We've seen in the last previous chapters, who don't have the mark of God, who are not God's people. Well, who is that? First century, who is that? That's Rome. So he's saying, trouble's coming. I'm going to protect you. The citadel, the center of... Oh, I have to relay this. So Josephus was a Jewish historian and a general in the Jewish army who defected to Rome and then became a consultant and an advisor to who became Emperor Titus, General Titus, when he was destroying Jerusalem. And he wrote voluminously. If you get a book with Josephus' writings, it's about 2 or 3 inches thick. Read it sometime. It's fascinating. He was a Jew, okay? Not a Christian. One place in there, he does talk about Jesus, and he says, this guy was the Son of God. You know, so it's a little bit, people argue about whether that was really his writings or somebody added it later. But he gives a detailed description of a lot of Herod's wars and conquests, Herod in the time of Jesus. And also he gives a very detailed description of the siege and eventual destruction of Jerusalem. Very detailed, down to the action that's going on in the battles in the city and in the temple. In fact, it's so detailed, there's one place where he talks about a great Roman centurion who was fighting, you know, trying to get in the temple, and the Jewish zealots were the last ones. They were kind of make a last stand in the temple. The rest of the city had already fallen. And they were taking the temple, and they were making their last stand in the temple, and this big Roman centurion, this great warrior, comes in the temple. The temple's all marble, right? It's marble and slick stone. He wore these sandals that had nails driven through them so that you could get around on a battlefield full of blood and bodies and everything. It's kind of gross, but you know, they basically had to have spikes. And it's so detailed that it says he goes in here to fight, and all of a sudden he's on this marble and he can't keep his footing. And he's falling down, and finally the guys all get around him and kill him. I mean, that's the level of detail. He was there watching. He was literally there watching the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, what's fascinating about this is that's not escaping. That's not escaping the people who are reading John's letters. The destruction of Jerusalem was only 25 years before. People knew the stories of the destruction of Jerusalem. How the city was held under siege, it eventually fell, and then the outer courts of the temple were the line of defense, and it fell. And finally, the Holy of Holies is the last thing, and it fell. They're thinking about this. Because John is talking about measure a temple, measure a city, it's going to get trampled. But then he says, this part is never going to fall. Where you are. The temple. Now, didn't Jesus say something about that? Remember Peter one day, we're talking with Jesus, and Jesus said, so who do men think that I am? What'd they say? Some say you're Elijah, maybe one of the prophets. And then he said, but who do you say I am? What'd Peter say? You're the Christ, the Son of God. And Jesus said, blessed are you, Simon, son of John. For flesh and blood has not revealed that to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you know, upon this rock I will build my church. That I am the Son of God. That's who he's talking about. And he says, and oh, by the way, I'm going to name you Peter, which means a stone, a little rock. Not a big rock, but a little rock. And what does he say? On this rock I shall build my church, and the gates of hell will never prevail against it. On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will never prevail against it. Now that's what we're seeing here. Satan is going to try to exterminate the church of persecution. He's going to put at his service the entire Roman Empire and all of their ability and every bit of wickedness he can throw at it. And Jesus says, and God says what? God's people win. They still win. If you are in the church, if you are the temple of God, if you are spiritual Israel, if you are my bride, and you remain faithful unto death, nothing can stop you. Nothing can conquer you. Are you going to suffer? Yes, you're going to suffer. Are some of you going to die? Yeah, a lot of you are going to die. Are you still going to be saved? Yes. Tim.
And he says all that, and in the first couple of chapters, he told them that, but also as you said, he told them that it's going to get tough, it's going to get worse, but hang on, and it'll be all worth it again.
Yeah. And what we're going to see in the next several chapters is a description of how it's going to get worse. So we'll stop there and we'll talk about the two witnesses next time.